Hello. I'm Darrow Alexander. I'm the Director of Health and Safety for the American Federation of Teachers. And since we have such an informal group today, I'd like to also introduce colleague Catherine Caney, who is in our healthcare division at the American Federation of Teachers. We represent not only teachers and school employees, but also healthcare workers and public employees. I also like to introduce another colleague back there, Jenny Young, who is with our sister union, the National Education Association. She's with the Health Information Network. I have the pleasure of doing work on occupational health and safety with both Catherine and Jenny, covering the many hazards that our members encounter on the job. I'm also a member of the Occupational Health and Safety Caucus of the American Public Health Association here, which is a very great coalition of not only public health scientists, researchers, and healthcare and public health workers, but also unions and activists who are really concerned about transformation of the workplace and making it safe and health. And on that note, we have someone from the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, Dr. Hope Teisman, in the back too. Okay, so I've got to tell you that I have no relationships to disclose. Sorry, could be titillating, I guess. Before I jump into asbestos here, let me just say that unions have traditionally been very concerned about working conditions and how those conditions have an impact on the health and well-being of workers. It's a message that doesn't quite resonate with the general public until we have a really huge disaster like the disaster in the Gulf when we lost 11 workers at the well, the BP well, or when we lost, I think, about 26 miners at a coal mine in West Virginia this year. People seem to think that part of the contract of going to work is for workers to take on a certain amount of risk with their health as part of the bargain for getting paid every day. And I think it's because of unions giving that those reminders that that's not part of pay, that's not part of the contract of having a job to take on those risks. Today we are in an interesting era when we don't have so many manufacturing workers in this country. In fact, we have more healthcare workers in this country than we do have manufacturing workers. Our service sector is huge. Until very recently, our public employment sector was huge. Now we're facing the brunt of the recession too. You know, people are hurting, they're out of jobs. We have a huge contingent workforce now, people who will not be in the same job for 20 to 30 years, but on the other hand, will go from job to job, you know, taking whatever health impact they experience on that job to the next job. And we believe that there probably will be some cumulative impact of this, and we're going to need to find a way to get a handle on documenting the impact of work on health. We also have, curiously enough, inside the Public Health Association and society in general, a great movement to get wellness and health promotion on the table to make people understand the importance of living a healthy life. And certainly unions believe that's essential. You know, you've heard from two presenters about some of those aspects. But we find in the occupational health and safety realm that too frequently the exposures and hazards of work are ignored and workers are sometimes blamed. You know, you have a cardiovascular condition, because you don't exercise or you don't eat properly, or you have type 2 diabetes because you don't take care of yourself, and or you got cancer because you didn't follow the recommendations for screening. And it's very curious. We don't hear the same kind of message as a society as a whole on, you know, pay attention to what you're being exposed to at work. Make sure your provider knows what you do for a living and what that involves. Let them know if you have any symptoms or illnesses that you feel are associated with your work. That message is not very prevalent, and I think that's something we in labor unions want to change, and to get the culture shift so that people understand there's a huge determinant here tied to work and health. Anyway, I thought, you know, this is the afternoon after lunch, you know, people are tired. And I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the health impacts that we found and really fought to change as labor unions. You know, I've been doing this work for about 30, 35 years, had the privilege of working with all different kinds of labor union folks, from the asbestos workers who tragically lost a lot of their brothers. They were insulators, plumbers, pipe fitters, exposed to asbestos. In any event, let me just give you the narrative of how labor has tried to weigh in on some of this. And for those of you who aren't familiar with this, you know, I think the last of the 19th century, someone invented or found the minerals, asbestos. For your information, there was a big mine in Staten Island, New York, mining asbestos at the end of the 19th century. That was, I think, Johns or Manville, one of the two who did that. Asbestos is a great product. It's probably more fire resistant than any other material that we know. It's also very strong and resilient. One of the best insulators we know. It also became one of the biggest killers of workers that we know. Asbestos became really big, especially after World War II. In commercial buildings, the insulators were spraying it on to the frames of skyscrapers. And luckily, a doctor in New Jersey who was an internist at the time, Irving Selikoff, started to see a lot of these workers in his practice and rang the alarm bell. We are still dealing with asbestos these days. There is a big fund and lots of pulling and tugging about compensating workers who have asbestosis, who have lung cancer, and even family members who were exposed because the workers took those fibers home. The unions gathered together to not only help get these members compensated, but also to get stronger OSHA regulations to make sure that people on the job are not exposed to asbestos. Lo and behold, you know, I'm in the teachers union. People think schools are really great, safe places, but we can walk in to a school, old school now, where we've got asbestos in bad condition that will pose a hazard to the maintenance workers who have to deal with it. And they still, to this day, don't have all the protections that they have, but, you know, we're still fighting. Coal dust, black lung disease, still a big problem in this country with those coal miners who go down. It's not only their life in an explosion or a big accident that is of concern, it's their lives as they grow older, try to get to retirement, and many with very, very scarred lungs, unable to breathe on oxygen tanks. This is something the United Mine Workers, the AFL-CIO, other unions have been, you know, fighting to get not only compensation, but improving the conditions in the mines. Coal dust isn't the only hazard those workers have down the mine. They have methane. They have diesel exhaust. Anybody care to guess why diesel exhaust would be an issue for a coal miner? Yeah, they take all that big equipment down there to get at those veins. And I know NIOSH has been working very hard to get, you know, good guidance on diesel exhaust exposure, and those particulates had a lot of resistance from employers who want to say that these aren't really big health issues, that these don't have an impact on workers. And we continue to fight that too. Cotton dust. We don't have much of a textile industry anymore, but we did since, I guess, the late 18th century. We had workers in textile mills exposed to cotton dust, and their story was not black lung, it was brown lung. And we worked very hard to get an OSHA standard to protect workers from cotton dust exposure, the unions did, in those textile factories. And that is another, you know, tragedy that should have been avoided and had a big impact on the health and the well-being of workers. Silica. To this date, we have huge issues with people exposed to silicon, sand, the tunnel workers who, you know, built tunnels underneath the Hudson to get people to into Manhattan, working on freeways. You know, they gave their lives, many of them, through their exposure to sand. We still have workers who get exposed to sandblasting on, you know, bridges, getting all that paint off, and a little bit of lead too. And silicosis is a disabling disease. And, you know, the unions, again, have been fighting for safer standards, making employers more accountable to what they expose people to. And let me tell you, this is essentially a political fight, you know. Even when we have the research on our side, we still have employers who will, you know, find their one or two researcher that will present extremely weak evidence that these exposures are not hazardous. But that's what unions do, because we want people to have good quality of life throughout. This is a recent issue that we worked on, in the unions did, you know, SEIU, AFT, AFSCME, the steelworkers, AFL, we all worked on ergonomics. Why? Because workers have really high rates of musculoskeletal disorders in the workplace. And this is across the board. You know, I could tell you, you know, our healthcare workers handling patients experience a lot of chronic back pain. You know, I've heard our nurse leaders say, chuckle, oh yeah, you don't see too many nurses over 50 out there in the units, do you? And one of the reasons is, you know, the wear and tear of working on the ward. We've got people who do healthcare of sorts in schools, in special education, who physically handle children all day. And they do so in some of the most primitive conditions there are. They also, many of them involuntarily, have to leave employment because of back injuries. We have truckers, bus drivers, people in UPS who take you all those wonderful packages when you order online. People across the board take these hazards, and they have an enormous impact on the ability of workers to maintain employment, and also they have an enormous impact on workers' lives maintaining good employment. We got an OSHA standard. We worked on that standard for over 15 years in the last days of the Clinton administration. We were relieved. It wasn't the best standard we could have gotten, but at least it put an obligation on employers to recognize these hazards, to record them, to come up with programs that would try to reduce these back injuries, these wrist, shoulder industries. Unfortunately, that was repealed by the Bush administration's new Congress in the following year, in 2001. I think it's the first action that the Republican Congress took was to repeal the ergonomic standard. That said, all of us in labor unions, AFL-CIO, Change to Win, we are fighting to get these kinds of safeguards put into place so workers don't end up leaving a job because they have carpal tunnel syndrome in both wrists and can't type anymore, or they can't handle a client or patient if they're a home health care worker. So this is a big issue. We're going to continue to fight it, too. So, these are just examples of things that we've worked on in the past. And as I said, the demographics of the workforce are changing. And some of the issues that are still big challenges for us that we're taking on are things like work-related asthma. Custodians, we're finding in healthcare settings and in schools, have a real high prevalence of asthma, probably associated with cleaning products that they are using. Again, these aren't well recognized. Many of these workers have their working lives cut short because of that. Infectious and communicable diseases, I think you're going to be hearing more and more about that. We had California just recently pass an airborne transmission standard that is probably going to be a model for us all over the country. We've had one pandemic last year. Thank goodness it wasn't real serious, but we were ill-prepared on protecting workers from that and the side effects of infection with influenza. We still have amputations, electrocution, and one really hard issue that we are taking on now is the cardiovascular disease and the mental illness that workers experience because of increased work-related stress and bullying. And I tell you, it's getting worse now. Corporations are sitting on trillions of dollars. They have seen this recession as a bonanza for them, laying off workers, making their workers more productive. So they're experiencing speed up. And that speed up is not just in manufacturing. That's in service sector. The hotel maids who are cleaning your rooms probably have more rooms to clean than they did last year. For us, the teachers have more students, bigger class sizes. They also have kids who are totally under stress. Their communities are under stress. We're going to see more workplace violence. We do already see that in healthcare settings. These are huge issues, and it's really going to be hard. We're going to be relying on our research friends who understand how these hazards can have a really potentially devastating effect on workers. But unions are going to be working on these, as we get through this recession, as we encounter more. We're looking at work because work has an incredible impact on people's quality of life. And I just want to return to that message that we want people to understand that they don't make a contract with the employer to accept the risks and the exposures and hazards wholesale. And we want workers to understand that when they go to a healthcare provider because they have asthma, that they talk about how they work and what exacerbates an asthma attack. When they talk about having, a back chronic back pain or carpal tunnel syndrome, before the hand surgeon rips them into the surgery to, cut that carpal tunnel, we want them to really get on record what work has done that may be attributing to their health issues. So anyway, unions are fighting for OSHA standards. We are very fortunate now to have a good OSHA administration, and they are going to be under the gun by the likes of the Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, and other prominent, well-resourced trade associations. But I hope that we're going to get some really good standards and one really sort of comprehensive standard. It's an injury and illness prevention program standard that would, for the first time, compel employers to assess their workplaces for exposures and then come up with a plan of action to address those hazards and to involve their workers in implementing that plan. And we're gonna be in the fight. We are responsible for so far getting the hazard communication standard passed. We used to call it Right to Know back in the 70s. The bloodborne pathogen standard, which is an excellent standard that protects workers who are exposed to blood. And if you don't know about it, it's a great model for all kinds of standards. Access to medical information and monitoring information. We got that standard passed so workers actually can have access to their medical records that an employer has. A union can ask for collective information if workers are all given hearing tests, for instance, or some kind of physical exam. And I mentioned the ergonomic standard that we worked so hard for, but we're fighting to rationalize that part of workers' experience and their health. So anyway, I mentioned the comprehensive injury and illness prevention program. I just want to leave you with this thought, and this is something that's not mentioned enough. We socialize the costs of work-related illness and injury onto society as a whole, because if workers have to involuntarily leave their employment or disabled early, who pays for it? We do. And it's inherently unfair and something that we need to get out in messaging too, that we're not going to tolerate employers socializing the costs of these work-related injuries and illnesses. And that's it.
Does anybody have any questions?
I have a question and a comment.
Okay.
A close relative of mine is a music teacher, and she is in a union, and she teaches approximately 1,000 kids per week. It's just sort of in and out, in and out, in and out. And yet, when you look at her health care coverage, it's pathetic. And she recently had a colonoscopy. She's about 57. She should have had the baseline colonoscopy when she was 50. She paid $500 in cost, even though she was in a union. And I'm wondering what can be done, and I don't see any solution, towards getting better health care coverage for teachers.
Well, that's a big question, and you know, my colleague over here can probably tell you about how the healthcare reform is going to, you know, ultimately lead to better coverage and better costs for all of us. I just want to say that as public employees, we are really under the gun right now. Most states are in a historic fiscal crisis. They're coming after our health care coverage and our pensions like gangbusters. And the argument that they make to the public is, well, you don't have health insurance, so why should they have it? Or you don't have a pension, so why should they have a pension? And so this is a constant battle for all of us who represent workers in the public sector, and we are, you know, trying to fight it. And I tell you, you know, I feel for your, is your cousin, you said?
I said a relative.
Relative, okay.
I don't want to get her in trouble.
Okay, well, no, we aren't collecting any names here. My husband is a high school teacher, and he has so many more students than he had even the year before, and it's really hard on him too. He actually works, you know, probably like your relative, 7 days a week, gets paid for 6 hours a day for 5 days a week, and it's really brutal. Our members are going to probably face another wave of layoffs fiscal year 2012, because with the new Congress, we're not going to have any more stimulus money to save jobs or, you know, pensions. And so I anticipate my husband will probably be, you know, teaching in an auditorium pretty soon, and probably your relative too. And I just hope that they save the music teacher's job with all these draconian cuts.
She's even lucky to have a music position job.
Yeah.
So many cuts have been made in the middle and high school levels, and she's in the elementary school, and that, you know, has been protected. And a lot of it was them lobbying hard the community, saying music really does affect your child's learning abilities.
Well, I mean, I hope this is something that communities make this Congress responsible for, because, you know, public education is one of the hallmarks of our country. I mean, you know, we've always been proud of that. We say we have a commitment to public education, but we've really fallen short over the years, and now it's just even getting worse, so we'll see.
If I can say something on that, and earlier I forgot to say that I have no conflict of interest. I don't have conflict of interest, but I'm a little biased on your question, because my father's a musician and my stepmother's a retired music teacher. And, you know, I actually asked her recently if she missed it. And she said, you know, at first she did, and she misses working with children, but she doesn't miss driving from school to school and the traffic she would sit in, because every day became a different school. And, you know, they were less and less. And unfortunately, remember the year after she retired, she found out the person who was supposed to move into her position, they decided to cut her position. And it was extremely hard for her because, you know, that was the impact of her retiring. You know, but, you know, SEIU represents public workers as well. We don't represent teachers, but we do represent public workers. And it's an incredible fight right now to protect those workers and to protect their jobs, let alone their health care and benefits. And the situation you have is you're brought to the bargaining table and you're told, well, you can take this cut in health care and pension, or we can lay off this many people. Yeah, and sometimes you end up in fights. Because there are people who know their job isn't at risk, who want to hold on to their health care and pension. And this is after years, you know. Our members in the state of Oregon have fully paid fully paid health care. But that's after years of giving up wage increases to keep that. And so then when you have the point come, which is, you know, it is why we have to get national health reform, and it's not going to solve all of it. But, you know, if someone does get a screening colonoscopy or screening mammogram, those will be free now for every American who has health care. Now, are there problems? There are little problems where if they find something in the colonoscopy and it therefore gets coded in a certain way, it's no longer preventive. And there are those things we're going to have to work to fix to make sure, and that might be able to get fixed through regulations much more easily than other things, but it's a step, and the more people we get covered, I do think the more costs will come down, because right now, every time, you know, more and more people become uninsured, if they go into the hospital, and that's uncompensated care, all of us who have insurance, our insurance rates end up going up, because the hospitals have to get paid for that. They can't just provide free care. In some ways, it has to get paid for. And hopefully the aspects of the law that are coordinating care will be able to reduce the cost, because we do have things right now where people do go to multiple doctors, and that's fine, but the records aren't connected, and nobody knows that they already had an MRI, and there's no actual check all the time with the insurance company. They don't always require checks, so you can end up having someone have multiple tests, multiple procedures that they don't need, or that actually, if you look at their medical records, realize that's not the best choice for them. So hopefully, if we can get the system to coordinate, you know, together we can start to bring those costs down.
I also want to mention, you know, I know on the occupational health side that we would like to see with the advent of, you know, health, the electronic health records, that they do capture some information about what people do for a living. And that would be such a bonus for us to really figure out what's going on with people, if their patterns in different kinds of jobs. And it's going to be hard to do that, you know, and because probably workers' comp issues, people thinking that, you know, they'll want to transfer the cost to workers' comp instead of to the insurance company. But I hope we will be, with health information, get electronically captured, that we get information about what people do or, and later on what they're exposed to at work.
Any other questions from the audience? I had a question for Danya about, I've been hearing a lot of discussions about employers dropping health coverage altogether and requiring, sort of forcing their employees into the exchanges. This is sort of a concern that some people have. I was wondering if you have thoughts on that. And
obviously, we can't tell what's going to happen exactly in the future. The best we have is pointing to Massachusetts, which does have an employer mandate, which is a lot lower than the employer mandate and the ACA. I think Massachusetts is just about $300 per year that employers that don't provide insurance have per employee have to pay. Under the Affordable Care Act, it's $2,000 per year per employee, per full-time employee. And there's been actually an increase in employer-provided insurance and very little what they call dumping in Massachusetts onto the exchange. So from that example, it suggests that we won't see that. Can I say there won't be any? I'm sure there will be some. There will probably be some employers who start offering, who weren't offering. For the small employers, they have a tax credit now, and there's a tax credit for them to buy through the small business exchange, that for the small employers who haven't been able to afford it, that might suddenly make it affordable. I know that we are actually working on trying to work with some groups to create models to try to figure out, well, what's better for our members? There may be a situation where members are better off and workers are better off in the exchange. We are doing a lot of new organizing of child care workers and home health care workers who are publicly funded, who don't have health insurance. They never had health insurance. It's very hard, especially in this economic situation, to get that public money for it. And it may very well work, instead of trying to get the money, that they may be able to get better benefits through the exchange. There may be situations where we have health benefits where we find that's the better option. And there will be the opposite as well. I think the biggest concern we actually have is where there isn't a union there protecting the workers, or where there's not adequate language protecting the workers in the contract, is a reduction in hours, because they only have to provide health care to workers who work 30 more hours per week. And if suddenly you have people dropping to 29 hours per week across the board, you have people losing access to health care. They may not have had it, but maybe they had other full-time benefits, or maybe they just have that income that they no longer have. So that's a real issue to, I think, be out there and watching out, and it's something that we're concerned about, and I think is more, in some ways, a concern where we're not organized. A lot of places where we're organized, we think we can protect that, or at least that becomes an issue you fight about, because it isn't just the access to health care, it's access to enough hours that people have an affordable wage, or a living wage.
Yeah. Do you have a sense of when we might know what's happening? Like, I can't remember when that's going to be phased in.
The health insurance exchanges start in 2014, okay. So in January 2014, they're going to also vary state by state. Every state creates their own exchange, individual exchange, and their own small business exchange. So until we see what those exchanges are like, what benefits they're offering, we don't really know. And I think it will also vary, you know, both in how good an exchange is will impact whether employers do that, as well as just the culture of that state. Texas and California are very different states, and even if in California, but California will probably have a much stronger exchange than Texas.
Well, that state's right.
I mean, that's what's going to happen. And I've done organizing in Texas. It's definitely, I haven't done but I've worked with recently organized. It's a very different view employers have with their employees. And there's not going to be a strong in this exchange. There may also be more employers who go, oh, but this is what's here now, just because of the culture of that state. You know, Massachusetts, yeah, it is a more, it is a different culture state. It is a state where I think employers feel a certain responsibility. But we've also seen with a lot, you know, when you look at certain, there are certain jobs, if they offer healthcare now, why are they offering healthcare now? You know, and it's, I've heard some people be like, well, they'll just pay the penalty because there'll be a penalty. Well, why are they offering coverage when there's no penalty then is the question. I think if it doesn't improve, if it doesn't improve their bottom line to pay it to offer it through the exchange versus what it would do to now not offer it, they may be offering because they know that they actually get better employees. They may offer because they have a union that's, you know, through years it's fought for them to offer. Or they may be offering because there is no other option for people.
Okay. Interesting. Stay tuned until 2014,
yeah. And work in your state to sort of be a voice to make sure that it is adequate and it's offered in your state.
So it's really up to the state legislatures to make the exchanges strong?
Yes, there'll be some federal regulations coming out, but the law actually doesn't include a lot of requirements as what, they, you know, there are certain minimum standards the plans have to meet, but there are a lot of open questions that will be left to the states, and it's really up to the state legislatures and the state governors to create the entity that's going to run these exchanges.
Okay. Interesting.
So, Arita, I had a question for you. I think I'm sort of like new to the food desert issue. I thought it was really interesting. I was wondering if there are certain grocery store chains that are more supportive than others, like in the other states. That I know it's new in Colorado and Denver, but in I think you mentioned Pennsylvania and New York. Are there certain grocery stores that are more likely to build stores in food deserts, and
yes.
Does it take tax credit incentives? Is that the only way to get them to
The tax credit incentive is specific to Colorado because we have, well, New York Jobs of Justice did it, and they're similar to us in that in certain areas where the grocery deserts are, so for instance, where we had our elected leader caucus, it was in North Glen, but right across the street was the city of Thornton. And so they fight over these tax incentives.
Mm-hmm.
So what we find often happens in our suburbs is Walmart is willing to build a super Walmart in the middle of this neighborhood, but they're the only ones because they don't need the tax incentives
mm-hmm.
or the TIF money to do it. And in fact, they say, we'll build barriers so you can't hear the traffic and we're gonna make the sidewalks pretty. And so we have to find policy, creative policy, that's going to bring in our King Supers and our grocery stores and people that are affiliated with the UFCW, so we know that the jobs going into these poorer neighborhoods are good jobs.
Mm-hmm. So has that been realized in the states where that has actually happened?
Yeah, what they're finding is the stores willing to move into the grocery deserts are the smaller stores that don't offer pharmacy services, and they just don't offer the services necessary to make them full access. So we're working really hard. King Supers has stepped up in the state of Colorado, and they're actually going to be willing to take different incentives through the government. So people who are on food stamps, for instance, because they've lost their job and so they need food stamp assistance for a while, they're going to be more willing to work with that, where that hasn't been the case up
mm-hmm.
until this point.
So how do you write policy that keeps Walmart out and sort of gets the smaller stores in that don't completely devastate the neighborhood?
Those are the policies that we're working on still. It's
okay.
It's going to be very creative and it's going to be difficult because the truth is the city of Westminster where I live is actually called the city of Walmart because we have one like every 2 miles.
Oh my God.
It's devastating. And it's because they're willing to move in and the city gets all these incentives from it, so they do it.
Mm-hmm.
And the city will boast about how, you know, they've never been in the red and we have all this extra money and we're going, yeah, that's because you're pimping yourself out to Walmart. So it's gonna be creative. And but we have elected officials talking about it and they want to change that, and they're disappointed with the number of Walmarts being built too. So they're willing to help push these policies along, and we stayed blue this election cycle, so there's a really good opportunity that we'll be able to start to push some of this policy this year.
That's great. Are there any other questions?
Can I make a clinical comment?
Sure, go ahead.
I just wanted to commend you. I'm from the state of California, and we had a hotly contested gubernatorial race, and the woman involved spent approximately $141 million to $142 million, and then I've also heard talk of about up to $160 million, so I guess she was funded by some other groups. She spent $57 per vote in the state of California. Her opponent, who was successful, spent $7 per vote. And much of that funding did come from unions. So I commend the unions for supporting Jerry Brown.
Yeah, it's going to be hard, especially with that Supreme Court decision. This election was just a warm-up for 2012. Probably we're going to see so much money poured in to that election cycle. Yeah. It's going to be obscene.
At least we found out that individuals putting their own money in doesn't win elections. I mean, yes. If anything, it showed that. But unfortunately, third parties putting money in,
yeah,
that definitely had a huge impact.
All right, thank you, and thanks to our presenters for their time today. We really appreciate it.